Good thing.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. I'm Dave Krueger. I'm very eager to engage with all of you. I see some new names and some familiar buddies from previous collaborations. You do realize you put pressure on me to come up with some new stories. You'll find in the link that you received when you registered and the one I resent with the two questions, the outline and resources. I would suggest printing that. And remember, I mentioned in the email, if you would manage background noise, to please do mute star six until you're ready to speak, because we have a large group, and I'd appreciate that. And when you're ready to speak, remember to unmute again, star six. So I'd suggest printing the outline. It's fairly annotated, so you don't need to take a bunch of notes. You can listen and see if it makes sense. There are some resources at the back of the outline that you may be able to work through and work on some of your own change and transition story in doing this. So thank you first for your responses that you've sent to the two questions that I sent around to each of you. What's the major question you have about this topic that's of greatest challenge or interest to you that you'd like to see us address? And secondly, if you walked away from this seminar series in 4 weeks saying it was one of the best ever, what would you walk away with? I appreciate your answers. It helps me a great deal. And I need, again, if I could ask you please to mute, star six. Would everyone mute, please? I can put us on lecture mode, but I'd like to do an open mic for our discussion at the beginning and the end of each seminar, because I'd like to get your responses, questions, and clarifications. And I'm going to ask if there are, in just a moment, if there are others who have not responded to those two questions, if you want to add that now, or if you changed your mind about what you sent in, let me know. These responses do help me a great deal to know what your interests and challenges are in this area and this application of coaching. I take your responses seriously, and I'm going to incorporate into the discussions that we have the responses to your questions and your reflections. And I encourage you, if you've not responded, to please do so. One thing I want to point out, notice the parallel of the two questions with how we frame each session with a client to determine what the client wants to focus on and what they'd like to take away. This collaboration follows a model familiar to most of you. The two questions form a framework, a map, that we co-create with a client to determine where the client is, where they want to go, how to measure progress along the way, and what's detour and what's distraction. And a map, like any focus, is important because of all the stuff you don't have to pay attention to. Same with one thing you focus on, it eliminates millions of other possibilities. So here's a suggestion that I have to each of you. And I want to ask again for a mute, star six. I tell you what. Save up your questions and responses. I'm going to put us on lecture mode immediately until we're clear about what what mute means and how to do it. So hold on just a second. Okay. I miss your immediate responses, and I'll save some time at the end for us to have more of a discussion. For the first seminar on the dynamics and developmental stages of change and transition, my suggestion and challenge to each of you, before you start thinking about applying these notions to your clients, consider how your story, personally and professionally, has changed and made transitions in the last almost year and a half with the pandemic. Then later, of how it applies to your work with clients. But at least wait until day after tomorrow before you start applying it to clients. So to best understand another person, notably your client, it's imperative to appreciate how that person sees the world, constructs their own story, and responds to their own perceptions and influences. So let's begin with the material and jot down any questions, clarifications you have, and we'll have a discussion at the end. As I mentioned, we're first going to talk about the dynamics and developmental steps of change and transition. First, what's your story? When we want someone to know who we are, we share stories, maybe of our childhood, our family, what's important to us. When we know people well, we know their stories. What's important, what shaped and molded them, the trials and turning points that have tested them. Our own story is a significant organizer of our experience, a continuity of where we've been, where we are now, where we'll go. Stories define, orient, and guide us. A story is never more necessary than at the time of change and transition, the time that's unsettling, confusing, uncertain, insecure. The ability to craft a good story at this crucial time is significant to the success of everything that follows. We learn through stories. We use stories to understand, to make sense of things, to remember. A good story bridges past and present to make sense of where we were, where we are, and the uncertain future. A critical element of our well-being is how we understand what happens to us and why. And some approaches derail because they attempt to change someone's behavior without considering what it means to their personal stories and their identities. So let's look first at the dynamics of change. This is all in your outline. The change is the event, the situation. You move to a new city, divorce, retire, have a significant loss, take a new job, lose an old one, or change careers, or simply respond in some ways to the pandemic. As we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the strategic goals. So there are some basic elements, I believe, in the dynamics of change. First, the idea of change will create anticipation. When we wonder what's next, it creates a hit of dopamine. In fact, Stephen King has said the only thing an author ever has to do to keep the reader engaged is having the reader continually wondering what happens next. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, maybe trepidation and even anxiety. Next, if you continue rather than returning to a comfort zone, expansion into a new experience, including the uncertainty, but then finally, the effectiveness and mastery. A couple of additional aspects of experiencing change may seem paradoxical. Now, these are not things that a client is going to tell you. These are things that I'm mentioning just because it helps us to inform listening. And here's a serious margin note. While we're talking about story, story is our metaphor to understand and put things together. For the client, they're not telling you their story. They don't have a story. They're telling you the way things are. So remember, this is for us as mentor coaches to help us organize and conceptualize and talk about how we can approach and engage and collaborate with clients. So the two additional aspects of experiencing change. First, every step forward means relinquishing a past position. This means that somebody's got to mourn. They've got to say goodbye, emotionally as well as practically, to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story, even if it doesn't work as well. This is a process. It's a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it, change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit, a pattern of behavior, or a hope by maybe if I just get this old story just right, this story just right and do it better, it's going to work. Back in the day when I practiced psychiatry, of several hundred young women who I worked with who had bulimia, and each thought this was a time before there was much about knowledge about this, everyone thought they discovered it because it was so secret, so embarrassing, shameful. Every one of them had to mourn the bulimia, even though it was devastating and harmful to them. It was, at a time, like their best friend. It was the one thing they could be effective in doing, they could rely on, and they had to mourn the bulimia to say goodbye to it as to an old friend. Even when it didn't work, it worked in a particular way. And secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. Because a carefully crafted old story always has some aspects of identity. And then suddenly, you realize there's a better way of doing things. You can replace it with something better. It's kind of like a narcissistic injury. It's like, wow, why didn't I know this all along? And then it's kind of embarrassing to recognize that you could have been. So that's an aspect. And to recognize the potential injury to self-esteem. So now I see at least six components in this dynamic of change. Again, these are not headlines. These are not things that you can label or a client's going to say, here's two and three for us to consider. These are just for your reflection to think about, like maybe internal conceptual markers, and these are in the outline as well. The myth that there is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice is going to solve all problems. It keeps hope alive. The disappointment, well, that nothing is really perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. That's also called adulthood, to use the scientific term there. The development, the recognition that no one's going to take care of it for you. That's the second developmental step of adulthood. The growth, to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation, the happy, sad experience that results. Happy about being effective, about maybe not even constructing an obstacle to move ahead, focusing energy on what you want, and sad about the mourning of an old story. So it's a paradoxical, happy, sad moment. Every transition begins with an ending, a change event, and we have to let go of the old before we can begin with the new. Every beginning ends something. And as Agnes Allen, American writer, said, almost anything is easier to get into than out of. Changing to a better job or career may ironically cause a similar grief and confusion as, say, the sad ending of an important relationship in the past. The reason it's important to recognize this is that some of the feelings you experience today may have nothing to do with the present ending, but come from a resonance emotionally with similar situations in the past. Letting go is difficult. Herodotus, Greek historian, 5th century BC, said, diseases most attack men when they are exposed to change. Even when we look forward to a change and anticipate it eagerly, some of us still hold on to what we used to be, what we wonder about whether the change was a good or a bad idea. We are defined and define ourselves by our roles and relationships, those we like as well as those we don't. These don't just suddenly change. You don't name it, make it go away, or make it happen. Letting go is an ambiguous experience. New skills are needed for negotiating this passage of separating the old from the new. The characteristic ways of coping with endings need to be understood. Each person has his or her own style of ending and new beginning. And I mention this because it may be helpful at times to have this concept as you listen to a client, and perhaps them understanding it from a different perspective might be helpful. People tend to respond to endings in their own typical way, to have characteristic reactions to endings and a similar mental state and mood. And I mention this because the basic tenet of mentor coaching is, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. The key ingredient here is you got to identify it first if you want to do more of it or if you don't. So, four of the most common styles of endings. Abrupt, designed to deny at times the impact and meaning of change. If I do it quickly, I just won't even see it and won't have to deal with it. Slower, gradual, so that it's difficult to see that anything important is really happening. An external focus. Some people learn to cultivate a subtle way of covertly inviting people to act upon them when change is in the air. That could also be called codependence. And finally, active or passive. In other words, proactive or reactive. Let's elaborate a little bit. Some people work to establish blamelessness in regard to ending. She just walked out. No warning, no nothing. She just left me. Like somebody who shouts, I didn't do it, when the police arrive. You know who to first question. How you approach change comes from the style you've developed for dealing with endings. That style this is an attachment pattern. We're talking about brain algorithms here. That style is likely to reflect early experiences as well as later influence and be consistent over time and situation. Typically, someone repeats a behavior pattern, as with other important issues and losses specifically. One person feels the grief and anxiety for the entire group. Another comforts the mourner. Another takes over the routine responsibility. And another assumes control for the situation. You've just heard described some examples of roles within a family that people fall into and repeat. Although it may be advantageous to understand your own style of endings, a part of you will resist that understanding with passion. Now, we're not talking about just big endings here. Divorce, career transition, job loss, children leaving for college, retirement. Even the small endings have their own personality that's consistent often with big endings. Think about how you tend to act at the end of an evening at a friend's house. Remember when that used to happen? Or after a night on the town. This really calls on your memory. Do you drag things out by starting new activities and conversations when others seem to be ready to leave? Do you suddenly say it was a nice evening and abruptly dash out? Did you say goodbye to everyone or leave ahead of plan so you could avoid the goodbyes? Notice how the small and large endings can be the same. Leaving a job, moving from a neighborhood, having dinner with friends. The person who leaves early and the ones who stay late both avoid endings in their own way, as well as the discomfort of the disruption. A dasher and a lingerer share the same dynamic. There are things we don't want to happen but have to accept. Things we don't want to know but have to learn. People we can't live without but have to let go. It's the ending that makes the beginning possible. Look now, I'm going to talk, this is in your outline, some principles of letting go. There are 10. Accept the reality as well as the importance of the subjective losses, of the meaning of the loss. Acknowledge the loss openly. Now, these styles may differ, but these are some principles to consider, some fundamentals. Expect and accept overreaction. Overreaction comes because of the emotional impact of the loss, as well as the past experience with losses that this present one resonates with. They kind of stack up that way. Expect and accept the process of grief and each of its 5 stages: anger, bargaining, anxiety, sadness, and then confusion and maybe even disorientation. Compensate for the losses. Ask, what can I give back to balance what has been lost or taken away? Learn as much as possible about the loss and its meaning in order to benefit from it. We'll talk about framing and mindset in a bit. Define what's over and define what is not over. Mark the endings. Rather than just talking about the endings, create actions or activities that dramatize them. When Rene McPherson took over the leadership of Dana Corporation, he saw that operations were choked by a culture of rules nobody could remember. In a management meeting, an initial meeting, he piled all the company manuals on a table. They formed a stack almost 2 feet tall. He then pushed them to the floor and held up a single piece of paper on which the corporate principles were typed. He said, "These are our new rules. Treat the past with respect. Consider taking a piece of the old story with you. And finally, endings ensure the continuity of what really matters. And the past, the good old days, that will be idealized at times and nostalgia, denigrated at times to distance it. The changes anyone experiences are different than anything they have ever experienced before, even though it looks the same. You've never been at this developmental place in your life before. The transition process by which people can get through change is a system that's well mapped. And those of you who have trained with me have heard me say many, many times, if you want to change, if you want to change a habit, if you want to create a new habit, you can think about the goal, but focus on the system. And we'll return to that. So let's look at the dynamics of transition now. The change event is the snapshot. The change process is the wide-angle view. The transition is the time-lapse photograph. The transition is the process of the internal story of change, even a shift in orientation, even self-definition. So this gets to the bedrock of identity. Transition is awareness of the seasonal cycles while attending to the daily weather. As you respond to change and embrace transition, you let go of the old story gradually, the outlived chapter, and evolve into your new story. You transform a new identity to internalize the changes, to sustain an enhancement. This is an answer to one of the questions I got about how you help someone program new identity or how you help them get the changes to really stick. It's the process of making the transition to the operating model of how and who someone is, their identity, because the identity, an identity like a belief, is an anatomical reality in the brain. We're going to look at a systematic way of how to do this. The transition story provides the coherence that will reassure in the present and foreshadow the future. The person you were yesterday is the person you are today, and the person you will be tomorrow, only more so. Yet, seemingly paradoxically, old stories need to be mourned, and along with them, the self left behind. You also have your own characteristic way of a new beginning, just as with endings. Change and renewal seems to involve new relationships, but they can also involve new places or projects. For some, it begins with a new state of mind, a new feeling, self-image, or goal. Sometimes, the beginning results from careful and conscious effort, but for others, important new beginnings have a mysterious and sometimes seemingly accidental quality, although we think we take charge of our lives and plan carefully to start again after an ending. Some of the most important beginnings take place in the unfocused darkness outside our awareness. An example. 2 years after my divorce, I was at an author's conference in Austin. I was planning to leave Saturday after the last conference meeting. I had just enough time to drive to my ranch between Austin in Houston to catch the sunset. One of the measures of the quality of my life is the number of sunsets I'm at the ranch. On the porch with a cigar and single malt, those are important characters I'll come back to later, single malt Scott, watching the sunset over the lake and trees. But I decided for some unknown reason to stay for the social hour, a wine and cheese event, nothing, by the way, to compare to my single malt, never mind the cigar and the sunset. There I met my future wife. 2 years later, we would marry on that porch that I didn't get to that evening at sunset. At sunset, with her children and mine attending. That was 16 years ago. Without a transition, change simply rearranges the furniture. People imagine that they can prepare for retirement by making specific changes, like adequate financial preparations, a place to live, developing new interests. Yet, the challenge is the transition itself, and change only prepares for that transition. People have to let go of the outlived chapters of their life story and find a new one to replace it. are the outlived chapters of a business story to create a new one? Write down this question right now, and then I'll tell you a 30-second backstory. Write down this question and write down, or never mind writing down, write down the first answer, the first word or phrase that comes to your mind when you hear this question. What is your unlived life? Write down your answer. Make it immediate. The reason I ask for an immediate response is when we give an immediate response, it engages the emotional part of our brain. It takes up to 10 seconds later to kick it up to our prefrontal cortex and make it make sense and logical. The first couple of retreats that I did for executives and business owners who were within a year of retirement, over 80% of them gave the feedback at the end of the retreat that that was the most important nodal event of the entire retreat of 2.5 days, because they hadn't, these bastions of success by any standards began to reflect on what they had not done, what was their unlived life. So, people have to let go of the outlived chapters of their life story and find a new one to replace it, or the outlived chapters of a business story to create a new one. At times, rituals and celebrations can further this process of transition and also serve as markers. Every lifetime has its own unique rhythm, and the personal developmental steps for both change and transition deserve attention. And remember, transition is a process. It takes time. No matter how many people you put on the job, it still takes 9 months to have a baby. Three components of transition. And I'll discuss each of these because you're going to see, hear, and collaborate about each of these with your client. First, there's an ending. Every transition begins with an ending. Then there's a neutral zone, an important directionless time in between, filled with mourning, with work, with getting ready. Then you finish with a new beginning. First, the ending. Every transition begins with an ending. Even though it sounds backwards, endings always come first, willingly or unwillingly. So the first task is to let go, whether at the individual or the organizational level, whether the source of transition is external or internal. The transactions always start with an ending. To start doing things a new way, you have to end the way you're doing them now. The most common mistake is to add a new pattern to the ones already existing. You're busy, you add a health club membership, doesn't work real well. The impact of the transition doesn't necessarily bear a direct relationship to the importance of the change that it triggered. One person can be brought to an abrupt standstill by a divorce or job loss, while another person takes it in stride. Somebody else may come to terms with a debilitating illness, yet be demolished by the loss of a pet. Here's one dramatic way to mark an ending of a story. And you may have heard this. Spanish explorer Hernando Cortes came ashore with his men at Veracruz, and he knew that his men were extremely reluctant about the dangerous exploration ahead, knew their trepidation, knew their awareness and fear. Some had even called it outright hopeless. Faced with a continent full of unknown adversaries, each person in his party was ambivalent about moving ahead or turning back. Cortes burned the ships. Here are some components of the ending process. There are five aspects of an ending experience. Now, these are not in order, and they're not sequential. They're not always clear, but let's discuss them anyhow. One is disengagement. Usual events disengage from the context and the identity in which people know themselves. Divorce, death, job change, move, illness. This disengagement can begin a process of change. Two, dismantling. Old familiar behaviors and habitual practices can be taken apart a piece at a time. This gradual transition involves slowly unpacking, perhaps, the last relationship, the lost relationship, including the lost identity that's part of it. An ending stops what it used to be. It's not the old way anymore, but not yet the new way as this dismantling occurs. Three, disidentification. Ending connections with what used to be, you also lose an old way of defining yourself. Old friends you didn't inherit, and the divorce, I still miss them. Often people describe this phase as not quite being sure who they are. Now, I thought about this a good deal when I came to terms with my planned retirement from my practicing and teaching of psychiatry and psychoanalysis at 25 years to become an executive mentor coach. For 25 years of practice and 7 years prior to that, a medical school and residency, I identified with being a doctor. I wondered if you, and I still do at times, if using the MD after my name was a way of hanging on to that identity, though I knew clearly I was no longer practicing and made a wholesale transition. The old identity can potentially stand in the way of transition as well as transformation and self-renewal, always something to consider. Four, disenchantment. Coexisting with a still vivid picture of the way things are is the split-screen image of how the way things were. Disenchantment is the discovery that, in some sense, your world simply is no longer the way it used to be. Disenchantment is a recurring experience throughout the lifetime of anyone who's had the courage to trust and believe in the first place. Some significant transitions began with disenchantment, the loss of a job, the loss of a relationship. Listen for this possible distinction in your clients. The disenchanted person moves on, while the disillusioned person can go through the play again with new actors on a perpetual quest for the elusive and fail to let go. And finally, five, disorientation. This affects a sense of place, space, as well as time. The usual way of even structuring time changes. The future's unclear. Now, these elements of ending, as I mentioned, are not in sequence. They're not in any particular order at all. For example, in a divorce, one partner may experience disidentification and disorientation and then decide to act, which leads to disengagement. If you're scoring that play, it's 3-5-1. The other partner, unaware of the impending change, begins an ending with disengagement and the challenge of disenchantment becoming disoriented. That's 1-4-5. There's no normal, no natural order to this sequence, nor is there any normal order of reactions to an ending. Endings are first rather than the last act of the play. Notice that only the first, disengagement, refers exclusively to external changes. The second, dismantling, can be either internal or external. The other three are all internal: disidentification, disenchantment, disorientation. It's the internal things that hold us to the past, yet we often try to deal only with the external issues because that's specific. We can deal with that. We're objective about that. To leave the relationship, the job, to move across the country. This focus uses change to avoid transition. To storm out of a job because of a bad boss rather than discover that what it is that keeps you finding and agreeing to work for such bosses. To end another relationship rather than letting go of the behaviors, the beliefs, the attitudes that keep choosing the same people and recreating the same relationships. Remember your friend from college who had numerous relationships, yet the dozens of faces were on the same woman or the same man? After someone struggles initially with a change and then begins to grapple with a transition, this is the true work, the beginning of transformation. Now let's talk about the mid-phase, the neutral zone. A resistance to transition is often not the problem of giving up a job or relationship, even an identity. The real problem is that time of nothingness that awakens old fears about abandonment and death. Remember this. People in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. We can expect this as part of a transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. We don't have a brain pathway that's been wired to let us know what to do. There's no default mode yet. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. And you can reframe this return to the familiar as perhaps a way of measuring progress to see how far you've come, as an opportunity to validate a commitment to move forward, or simply the challenge to look at what's next rather than to go back into the problem that's going to edge it further in your brain. This in-between time of transformation is the real work of letting go and prepares the foundation for the next stage. Now, it's important not to rush through this neutral zone too quickly to avoid or minimize the disruption. It's a work in progress. When I went through my career transition, I needed a time in between before I began my new career. I knew that I was a medical professional in my mind and heart. No matter how far ahead I planned for it, I thought maybe I'd be tempted to return to that identity and style of being when I was in doubt or wondered, you know, where I'm going to get my coaching clients. So I made a wholesale transition to retire completely from medical practice and close it out in every way, then to spend some time at my ranch riding and physically working before I began training for certification at CTA as a professional coach. Now, in another era, the person in transition left the village, and I didn't know this at the time, and went into a forest or desert to remain for a time. Removed from old connections and without old identities, the old reality changed as well. This in-between time of empty space fostered a generation of a new sense of self. Actually, mine was way closer to caveman than I realized. When someone doesn't allow this essential period of time to create a transition, some important work can be avoided. If the transition is treated like an event, like crossing the street, a whole process is averted. And often somebody, without even knowing why, finds ways of being alone and away from familiar distraction. Sometimes it's a long weekend, alone in a quiet place, having the time to think things over and not do much of anything is the point. One of the significant transitions in work life is an internal one. It's likely that someone after the age of 40, people in transition, they change from being motivated by the chance to demonstrate competence to being motivated by the chance to find personal meaning in work and its results. This shift is from the question of how to the question of why. Competence begins to lose its force as a source of motivation because to do the same thing and over again becomes less challenging, less invigorating. The brain plays a role in this. So this is, again, dopamine is the brain chemical that induces excitement by anticipating pleasure or reward. The hit of dopamine, the pleasure principle, motivates people to take risks to anticipate something exciting. Neuroscientists have shown that anticipating a reward can be even more important than actually receiving it, because once we do something, then it shifts the system to the marathon instead of the sprint system. So that means something that's long anticipated and exciting can be met with, wait a minute, even buyer's remorse. So what we do in coaching, and this can, let's look at a coaching context. Clients can hit plateaus in coaching after 1 to 2 months. They've dealt with all the things that are challenging. They've addressed the things that they have come to know about. Now, serious change and not knowing what's next, they began to consider suspending work. So what we can do in coaching is to ladder challenges and successes frame each step as what's the challenge, what's the next step. By knowing this phenomenon, we can address and explain it as a natural development. Two questions to focus on the meaning of transition at any time in life. What is it time to let go of in my life right now? Transition starts with letting go. And two, what is waiting to make its entrance into my life now? That answer is usually something internal, subjective, often in the shape of an idea or question you may ask yourself. It may feel like a message to you, a message that something is standing just outside the door of everyday awareness, waiting for your attention. I saw this in my therapy and analytic practice. It's not the loss of someone that creates problems, but the failure to internalize that person and relationship. For some, their present consists in part a past that they haven't quite let go of. Here's an illustration of the emptiness of this neutral zone in Leo Tolstoy's description. I felt that something had broken within me on which my life had always rested, that I had nothing left to hold on to, and that morally my life had stopped. And yet I could give no reasonable meaning to any action of my life, and I was surprised that I had not understood this from the beginning. My state of mind was as if some wicked and stupid jest was being played upon me by someone. I asked myself, what will be the outcome of what I do today? What I shall do tomorrow? What will be the outcome of my life? Why should I live? Why should I do anything? The reasons for this emptiness between the old and the new include the process of transformation is analogous to a death and rebirth. It's not a mechanical modification. The process of disengagement and reintegration is the source of renewal, just the way an apple tree needs the cold of winter. So here's a summary of creative use of this neutral zone. Embrace setbacks, losses, disadvantages as entry points into new solutions. Perhaps consider a regular time and place to be alone, to step back, to question the usual, to look at new and creative solutions. Provide opportunities. This is all in your outline. I'm just going to hit the highlights here and let you look at this in more detail. Provide opportunities for others important in your change and transition to perhaps step back and review as well. Accept your need for this time in the neutral zone. Consider engaging in training and techniques of discovery and innovation. Engage in experimentation. Try out ideas you'd wished you had the chance to try. Keep a log of neutral zone experiences. Take this pause in the action of your life, perhaps to write an autobiography. Think of what would be unlived in your life if it ended today. Back to that question, what is my unlived life? And lastly, reflect consciously on the present transition experience in your own life. This neutral zone, the time between the old and new, is a rich time for that insight. And three, finish with a new beginning. A new beginning follows the ending, and the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. It's when the endings are finished that we can truly begin. You have to be in a new story before you can totally give up the old story. Now, we may not always know when the ending is complete and when we've been in the neutral zone long enough, especially when the path is a genuinely new beginning. For a time, we may not even know which is the real path. Think about the important beginnings in your own past. You bumped into an old friend you hadn't seen for years, and he told you about a job at his company that opened up that morning. You met your spouse-to-be at a party you really hadn't planned to go to and almost skipped. You picked up a book that changed your life because there was only one lying on a friend's coffee table when you stopped by for an unexpected visit. The lesson in these experiences is that when we're ready to make a new beginning, we will find or create an opportunity to learn. The Chinese proverb, when you're ready to learn, a teacher will appear. There will be a wine and cheese event. New beginnings will occur with an internal realignment rather than an external shift when we are aligned with deeper longings, when needs or ideals align with purpose. When you have time, schedule an appointment with yourself, I would recommend, and do the needs and ideals exercise in the resource section of your outline. I think it will be helpful and important. Never underestimate the change back pressure from the system, your family, your company. It's their self-statement of reaction to change, an attempt to restore normal order and not do the work of change. Our brains are pattern recognition organs. We will naturally try to go back to the old way of doing things. The brain doesn't know, and the mind has to lead to a better way. A group or a system has a status quo bias and inertia. Their brains are also wired, just as we are individually. Remember that Jung said the most important problems may not be able to be solved. They have to be outgrown, outlived. The important distinction here is this. Have you really moved to the endings and the neutral zone to find the beginning you now want to follow? Or is this beginning a way of avoiding an ending or aborting the neutral zone experience a little too early? One thing you can do is to begin to identify yourself with the final result of the new beginning. What's it going to feel like when you've actually done what you're setting out to do? Remember, the major reason that we do what we decide to do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. And we understandably have ambivalence about new beginnings. We've not established a comfort zone yet. We haven't grooved a default zone in our minds and brains. We don't know the outcome. We don't know how it's going to turn out. And that creates anxiety and trepidation. So beginnings may reactivate some old anxieties as well as making it very real that the ending has happened. The risk and uncertainty of the new beginning will resonate with past anxiety, maybe even trigger old memories, including memories of failures. And a new beginning will erode the equilibrium of the neutral zone. For example, one of the most challenging aspects of being an adult and taking care of ourselves is that we have to come to the end of the past, the hope that somebody else is going to do it for us. And it's more difficult to let go of what never was than even what was there, traumatically so, because you have to give up a hope of having it exactly in the way you wanted it. Also, with that, the illusion that there's going to be some ultimate arbiter of fairness. New beginnings need to have a clear sense of purpose. To reinforce a new beginning, you'll have to evolve a new identity that replaces the old one. In the beginning, take things step by step. Recognize the assumption and resist the temptation that some other route may go smoothly with events always exciting and meaningful. It's like comparing yourself with somebody else. You're comparing your inside to their outside. Never an apples-to-apples comparison. It's important in a new beginning not to be preoccupied with results. Be preoccupied with the system. This is an important aspect of a new beginning, to shift your purpose from the goal to the process, the system of reaching the goal. For example, the new job is to find a job. Every transition is a transition from something into something. And there are very few times that we actually have direct contact with our future selves. We seldom review our present circumstances as they might appear to a relative objective future self. When we plan ahead, we specify goals rather than future development of identity or states of mind. Now, one example of this, Emily Pronin at Princeton has shown that when we can envision our older self, say in the 70s and 80s, there's a threefold greater saving for retirement when someone can visualize this. Some great studies have shown age progression with the same enhanced saving for retirement. So, here are some considerations in summary to reinforce the new beginning. Be consistent. This is the best way to get an idea of how something will work, to be consistent, to be totally immersed in the process. Shrink the change to ensure stepwise success. Evolve ultimately a new identity. Maybe generate a symbol of this new identity, a representation that can be a consistent point of reference. And celebrate small successes. Now, to end, before we have discussion, a question and a challenge. Here's the question. Imagine a photograph of you framed 100 years from now. A photograph of you right now, 100 years into the future. What is the story you most want your great-grandchildren to tell about you? Make that one sentence and make it immediate. Doesn't even have to be a sentence. So here's the challenge. I'd like you to close your eyes and envision this with me. Get very relaxed. Take a deep breath in for relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Keep your eyes closed and follow this suggestion. What if right now is a turning point for you? The time your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. The time you awakened your deep passion and acted on it. The time you did what you were always meant to do. Or, this moment of truth may be a brief awakening, silenced by the sensible obstacles you're familiar with constructing. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content telling stories about your favorite sports team or what great cookies you used to bake. It will all depend on how brave you will be. We're in discussion mode now. If you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in any clarifications, questions, things that you'd like to comment on, and how you're hearing this. From anyone, what's the one thing that's most important that you're taking away? I'd really love to hear from some of you about what's the most important thing, because I think it helps us each to really focus for each of us. Frederico, I know you're there, and I know you're about ready to speak. What's the most important
thing? I am.
You are taken away, my man.
So I was intrigued what you said at the end about the representation of the new identity. If you can expand a bit of that, you talk about a symbol or a representation.
Would you say that question again to expand on what specifically?
Yes, you mentioned just at the end, you know, sometimes it's important to create a representation or a symbol of the new identity.
Public Cumhill.
Yes, and again, manage the background noise, everybody else on mute. I'll And thank you for that. It may simply be the way a writer puts in a room where he or she writes something that represents the book that they're going to write, something that keeps them focused as an identity as a writer. It may be something that simply represents the new identity as a consolidation, a solidification of this, because it's not yet a brain reality. It's not yet a part of what's etched. So it's a process, and we create a system to get there, but it also may be a tangible way of looking at representing this as a way of moving toward it, simply the way we keep something as a memento of the past in order to remember where we no longer are. You know, it's kind of like saying she was never more aware of feeling like a little girl at the very moment she recognized she was no longer one. So something that represents the past and the future helps us perhaps sustain the process and the system of working toward it while we're engaged with all the uncertainty and the trepidation of being in between. And I realize this is more like a Rorschach than a real answer, but how you and what you find to represent that needs to be very specific for you, but make it very representative of where you want to get to, what you want to do.
Right.
Make sense?
Is it a way of kind of tricking the brain to reinforce a certain idea or a certain concept?
Not a trick, but an orientation. You know, think of something like a vision or a SMART goal. You know, a vision rewires the brain. When you repeat it, it rewires the brain. The affirmations revise the mind software. So think of it as creating a vision. Some people do it as a vision board to look at where they want to get to, what they want to do. Think of where you want to get to if you're going to write a book, you know, on a piece of paper. Write on that piece of paper the title and the subtitle of your book and by your name and stand it up. It's going to be there. That's just one. It's kind of a goofy example, but you'll have to fill in each of you your own examples of that. So thanks for that, Federico.
Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Other thoughts, questions, things that you'd like to discuss further or have as a major takeaway?
Can you hear me?
My name is... I'm sorry.
Okay, I heard Amy, and then I'll come back to who I didn't hear. Go ahead.
No worries. Go ahead. Please, Amy.
Amy, you go.
I'm not sure. I'm not Amy.
I'm sorry. I misheard. Tell me your name.
My name is Jonna.
Jonna. Okay, yeah, please. Go ahead.
I was just going to share... you call it the neutral zone, and I kind of refer to it as in the meantime. Like when you're in transition, it's in the meantime, the time in between. And I could kind of see myself transitioning, like you said, about the pandemic, changing from one career, so to speak, stepping into the new one and kind of being in a hurry to get that thing going with coaching.
Yeah.
And just kind of settling back and realizing it's important to allow for that time, the neutral zone, the meantime, and kind of heal in that place and to have that time of sort of like the changing identities, the transition, the morphing into the next thing and not. It kind of makes me think about relationships when people jump from one relationship right into the next and they don't give any kind of healing time in between. And you kind of don't really fully feel your feelings because you just jump right into the adventure and the unknown of the next thing, the dopamine hit.
Really important point, and I appreciate you making that. And I think it's important not to rush it, and something that we may think of with a client, and I've even said this, to a client who may question that and question if they're delaying or prolonging or if they're respecting the process, I think you will always know the difference between dosing, timing, and titrating from avoiding. And that puts not only the respect, but the onus on the client to self-reflect and examine further, but the confidence and maybe a way of looking at that to do that. Now, I know we're over time. If you'll go 30 extra seconds, I want to hear the question or the point from who also responded at the same time. Would you please go?
Yes. Hi. My name is Yusuf Wilson, and I am a career coach, and I'll make it real short. The big takeaway for me was right around the same three components of an ending. Dr. Henry Cloud does a really good job with talking about endings and borders, boundaries rather. And I will amplify what you just talked about in terms of the neutral zone and how it's that messy period. And that's where I have a lot of my clients. That's where they need tons of support and tons of encouragement in order to get through that messiness, because they always want to, you know, revert back to the ending.
Exactly.
And how they were wronged in some way, or how it was someone else's fault. So I know you're running out of time, and but this is really critical and messy stuff, but it's critical to helping a client move forward and really take advantage of the new beginning.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Ray. I appreciate that. I tell you what, we do need to stop. I'd like to have you plan on, if you have the time and interest, our last seminar, our week four. For those of you who'd like to hang around and just have a discussion and more question and answer after the top of the hour, I'll hang around with you and engage in a discussion for things that we don't get to between now and then, or things that or challenges maybe that you think about. So also, I encourage you to send me the answers to your questions by email, and I'll put them in the hopper, and those are really highly important and influential to me, and I thank you for those of you who have already sent it. So we'll pick up right here next time. Take good care of yourselves. Thanks so much for the energy, interaction, and all the responses. I'm greatly appreciative. Bye now.